Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, President's Day, the 15th of February. All things political coming up this hour, and we have so much to talk about. Joan Walsh is our guest. She is national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. Her most recent piece is on the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, and she writes, Mitch McConnell wants Obama to have a three-year last term just because McConnell's insistence that Obama shouldn't nominate a new Supreme Court justice is expected. That doesn't make it normal. It is outrageous. We'll be talking about the death of the Supreme Court justice and the political response to this, which has been vociferous. Also, a couple debates since we last spoke. Scotty and I went to the Democratic debate. PBS aired this on Thursday night, held at UW-Milwaukee. And so we gathered some clips from people who were in the spin room. Also, we've had, it feels like all we do is watch debates now, isn't it, and cover this race. And we have so many months to go. Republicans had another debate on Saturday night, and so we will talk about that as well. And welcome your phone calls for Joan. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. The appointment of someone to replace Justice Antonin Scalia, should it be left to the new president to make that decision? I'm sure that will consume a lot of our conversation this hour. Joan is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. She is the author of What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America. She was editor at large for Salon.com, and she's a regular commentator on MSNBC and other networks. She went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison and graduated from Shorewood High School, so she has a lot of Wisconsin ties. Hi, Joan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I'm happy to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. On this President's Day, your view, the three most consequential presidents.
Wow. I would have to say Lyndon Johnson, FDR, and Abe Lincoln. Nobody warned me about that, so that's off the top of my head, Kathleen.
I think that's what was first on my mind. We're talking about Lincoln Hour 2 of the show, and it's President's Day, so I knew you'd have an answer to that. That's interesting that you made those three. Washington, would you put Washington in there, number four, maybe?
Sure, of course, because of you know, where he stood. And, you know, I think it's early. It's just way too early to talk about President Obama, but I think, you know, 20 years from now, there will be people who put him in their top three because of, you know, the Affordable Care Act and a lot of other things that he's done. So, mm-hmm. And depending on how he handles, depending on how the next appointment unravels or unrolls,
right,
that could have a bearing too. So. Mm-hmm. Lots of competition. We've had some great presidents. We've had some flawed ones.
Mm-hmm. It is amazing, the news of the weekend. Nobody saw this coming. We all, when we looked at our news feeds on Saturday, went, oh, my gosh, he seems young to have died. He was so influential, and we can just imagine what's coming politically, but it didn't take long for it to become pretty political.
Right, and I'm glad that we all feel like 79 is young, because I do
know.
Too. I mean, he was not, you know,
yeah.
He was not somebody that we were standing around saying, oh, you know, I mean, poor Justice Ginsburg is always, she's had some health scares, so she's always the one who is the focus of attention, and, you know, liberals even suggesting, oh, she should retire, President Obama can make, you know, can make a selection, and, you know, I've written about why I thought that was a bad idea, and I think we're seeing part of why it's a bad idea. President Obama is being denied the fourth year of his term by Mitch McConnell and his Republican Senate friends. It's really outrageous, but there's just, you know, for the last couple years, there's been no denying that the president would have an uphill battle simply performing his duties, given the obstruction from the Republican Senate.
Well, it is amazing. He has almost a whole year left in his presidency, Joan. You wonder if the American public won't say, wait a second, it's in his constitutional duty to do this. It would be terrible for him not to nominate somebody and have a whole year go by.
You know, the Constitution doesn't read he should or maybe he should. It says he shall appoint. And it doesn't say he shall appoint up until February before the next election. It's very clear. It's not merely an option that he has. It's not merely a right. It's a responsibility. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Kathleen, the thing that bothers me the most about this, I expect Republicans to obstruct. That's what the party has decided is best for it these days. But what I don't expect is the kind of media rolling over and just playing this as a merely partisan debate, a dispute. Which side are you on? You know, the Democrats or the Republicans? You've got to be on the side of the Constitution. It's clear what the president has to do. Now, can they subject his nominee to a very aggressive review process, nomination hearings? Absolutely. They've done it before. Democrats have done it before. That's to me, that's a separate issue. But there are actually people saying, including media people, suggesting that it's a divisive thing for this president to do, to perform his duties. And that's just a measure to me mm-hmm. of how polarized our country has become. Mm-hmm. It's really disturbing.
So what, if anything, can the president do to rise above the divisiveness?
You know, I guess I've kind of given up on giving the president advice about rising above the divisiveness, because no matter how much he rises above, they drop the floor, you know, or they rise. I don't know. I don't know what my analogy should be. I don't know what he can do. I mean, I've got to say, Justice Ginsburg has said part of the reason she was not going to retire, in addition to the fact that she feels great, is that she doesn't believe that the president has the freedom to make a truly liberal appointment, to appoint someone like her from, you know, who came from the ACLU. And with a real history of both feminist and civil libertarian concerns. So I expect the president to appoint someone who's rather centrist, and probably who I consider a little bit, you know, too centrist. So, you know, I assume he will do something. I don't think he's going to appoint, you know, a firebrand. I think that's already baked into his decision-making, and it's quite frankly baked into his own ideology. I think he, despite the opposition he's faced, I see him as someone who is, you know, certainly to the center from me, who is certainly a conciliatory person, and who's not an ideologue. So I think regardless of this whole ruckus, I think he would be appointing someone that he hoped would get some Republican support.
He does have, we were trying to figure this all out this morning, he does have open to him a recess appointment. Do you have a full understanding of this? Could he do that, and then the Senate would not have to do a confirmation for a long period of time, and he could nominate whoever he wanted?
That is my understanding. I know that Republicans floated this. President Bush floated this, or his, you know, some of his supporters, back in 2006, 2007. I believe he has the right to do that. It would be, you know, a hugely controversial
yes.
thing. I feel like if I were a Republican, I might be telling, and it were a Republican president, I might be telling him to do that, and that as a progressive, I should tell him to do that. I'm right this minute, I'm agnostic. I do believe it would be a hugely controversial thing for him to do. It might be the thing that he ought to do. I'm going to just stay neutral on that question right now.
And what about the chances of McConnell blocking a hearing, you say, and vote that would take GOP obstruction to a new level? Do you think that's in his mind right now?
That's what he's basically said. I mean, that's what he's basically said. We should leave this up to a new president. You know, I just want to go back over this. He said the American people deserve a voice, so we should leave it up to a new president. The American people have a voice. They used it in 2008 and again in 2012. We elected him for 4 years. He has 4 years. Mitch McConnell is denying a majority of the country its voice with this maneuver. Now, was it a trial balloon where he will back down because of the outcry and also because it's kind of unconstitutional what he's proposing? It's possible. It really is possible that if there's enough of a ruckus, that's my word of the day, he will backtrack. I think he's a political person. And so I think it's possible that he would go ahead if the when the president makes his appointment, he would go ahead and schedule hearings. But at this point, from the sound of his statement on Saturday night, the sound of that is no, we're not going to have hearings or a vote.
Mm-hmm. And then you have all these issues, and this is just a short list of them, the public sector union issue that's coming up, affirmative action, redistricting, abortion rights, immigration. No action will be taken by the Supreme Court, right? Because in what would be expected to be a 4-4 vote, there wouldn't be any decisions for a long
time. Right. I mean, there are still things that we, you know, that where it's not deadlocked. We don't pay that much attention to those things. There will be decisions that are binding, that are precedent setting, et cetera. However, there will be some that aren't, where there really is that 4-4 deadlock that we've talked about. And you know, so I think public employee unions probably got a good break on that, but abortion rights supporters in Texas probably got a bad break. So the point is that what happens now is if there's a 4-4 tie, the ruling of the lower court stands. So the lower court ruled for the public employee unions in the labor case we're talking about, but against the abortion providers in Texas in the other case we're talking about. So, but it's just such a kind of a crummy way, to proceed. We have a Supreme Court for a reason. And the idea that some Republicans are just comfortable, with just not having a court to weigh in here is just mind-boggling. It just shows the lengths to which they will go to delegitimize this president.
In Saturday night's debate, Senator Ted Cruz claimed that there had not been an election year Supreme Court appointment for 80 years. The moderator from CBS corrected him and said that Reagan had confirmed in 1988 a Supreme Court nominee. And the response to the crowd to the moderator was unbelievable. He was booed.
He was booed.
What was that all about?
He was booed and he apologized. I mean, basically he performed the role of a moderator. Someone on the stage said something that was absolutely false. He didn't need a fact checker to weigh in. And let me also say, John Dickerson is a very centrist person. I sometimes disagree with him. I don't perceive him in any way as liberal-leaning. I'm sure we might have conservative callers who will disagree with me, and that's fine. But my experience with John Dickerson, he's written for Slate for years. I was at Salon. I've followed his career. He is a down-the-middle kind of guy. What Ted Cruz said was an absolute lie. And he stood up and he did his job and he had to A, apologize, and B, get booed. He said, I apologize. I'm just trying to bring the facts here. And the crowd booed the facts. It was really a shining moment.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that debate? We'll talk about the Democratic debate as well. It was it got kind of wild, didn't it?
It did get wild. I mean, there's so much enmity in that group. There's a lot of people now who really don't like each other. It's becoming personal and less about issues, and it's kind of distressing to see. I mean, you know, I've got to say, Donald Trump, for once, kind of told the truth, or told some version of the truth about how we got into Iraq, et cetera. And, you know, the many, not just allegations, even the bipartisan 9/11 commission felt that the administration had ignored a lot of warnings leading up to 9/11. It wasn't, it was of some concern to Democrats and Republicans. So there's some basis for Trump saying that, but the way in which he did it was just so personal and so ruthless. Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz don't like each other much either. It's gotten kind of ugly.
I know. You would have thought Marco Rubio would know that Senator Ted Cruz spoke Spanish.
Wouldn't you?
It was amazing.
It was really amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, especially because, Marco Rubio is trying to run as fast as he can away from the only thing he's done in the Senate, which is co-sponsor the bipartisan comprehensive immigration reform bill that did pass the Senate. So I can see why Cruz was a little bit surprised, because he's definitely not playing the I'm a Latino card I shouldn't say in any way, but in general, he's not. And then that moment, he broke it out, and look, Ted Cruz, he's a smart guy, and he knows enough Spanish to come
right,
out with that.
Right.
And I laughed out loud, because I wasn't sure either. You know, it's like Marco, if you're going to make a charge like that, you really should know
absolutely
whether it's true or not.
Absolutely.
And he didn't.
Yeah. So some have been writing today that Jeb Bush simply has to perform well in South Carolina or it's the end of the line for him. Would you agree?
I don't know if I agree, only because he's still got money.
He has a lot of money, doesn't he?
Yeah. He's still sitting on a lot of money, and it's become so bitter and it's so fractured, you know? I mean, Rubio really did, you know, claim coming out of Iowa that he was going to consolidate the, quote, establishment support. He blew the debate and he blew New Hampshire, and so he didn't. You know, there are all these stories about how the Republican donors are, quote, frozen in place. I never thought I would feel sad for a Republican donor. I don't really. But, you know, they're having a hard time. They don't know which of these guys to give to. Chris Christie dropped out, God bless him, but there's just not a whole lot of clarity. Kasich did very well in New Hampshire, but I don't expect him to do that well in South Carolina. So, you know, in terms of that establishment lane, which, you know, let's be honest, somebody is going to emerge to run it, you know, in that lane. It's likely to be down the road, Trump, Cruz, and somebody kind of sort of establishment. I think it continues to be fractured. I mean, mm-hmm. if Rubio has a really great night, you know, let's talk next week. If Kasich surprises us, maybe that would change things. But I just think money, you know, the fractured status of the race and spite is going to keep Jeb Bush in there for longer than somebody named Jeb Smith would be hanging around. Mm.
Well, welcome phone calls. Joan Walsh is our guest for All Things Political today, and we're talking about, obviously, the big news over the weekend, the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, and what's happened as a result of that death, whether or not the Republicans are calling for the president to not make a new appointment, even though the Constitution clearly says that he shall make an appointment when this kind of thing happens. And we'll see how this plays out politically, if it behooves the Republicans to try to hold up a nomination until, if a Republican is elected, and there's an if there, they can make an appointment. Should it be left to the new president? That's our question to you this hour. We're also looking at two debates, which took place on Saturday, and then the debate in Milwaukee, the Democratic debate, which we haven't yet discussed with Joan and with you. Scotty and I were there, so we'll tell you a little bit about our impressions. Joan Walsh is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. She is a commentator regularly on MSNBC, author of What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America. Here is our phone number. We'd love to hear all of your political thoughts on our All Things Political segment, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So we'll go to your phone calls at 800-486-8655, and let's start with Connie in Blue Mound. Hi, Connie.
Hello, Kathleen. I was listening and, you know, caught the fact of this problem of getting along with Congress that the media really didn't pick up on right at the very beginning. When Obama was elected and they did an interview with Mitch McConnell, I don't know the station or whatever, on television, but his demeanor, McConnell's demeanor, his look, and his angry words set it all for me, and I actually feared for our newly elected president's life because of the tone of McConnell's voice and his demeanor. And that set the tone for the next 8 years and inflamed a lot of people, I think, in the legislature, but also just regular folks. And I think it's very, very sad. And now here we go again with Mitch McConnell saying these things and being so obstinate. So I really feel the media. I really blame the media for not. They always think it's so much Obama's fault that they're not getting along, but I really, it goes back to that one moment in my mind that just scared me.
June.
I have to agree. You know, there's a legendary meeting. I don't know if McConnell was at it. My memory says he wasn't, but, you know, Newt Gingrich, a bunch of current Congress folks who met on the night of the inauguration, and they were down in the dumps, and they came together, and they said the best thing we can do is stick together and block him. And so, you know, I remember as the president was still negotiating the terms of the stimulus, the recovery package that he got together to get, help us avert a depression. He was heading to Congress to talk to them about it. He'd been rejecting Democratic ideas to make it bigger because he wanted Republican votes. And as he was leaving to meet with John Speaker Boehner, I guess he was pre-Speaker at the time, Boehner came out and told the TV cameras he was already opposed to it when it didn't exist yet. There were lots of ideas out there, but there were some Republican ideas that the president actually incorporated. Same thing happened with the Affordable Care Act, and that's where I remember McConnell speaking out vociferously and saying, if we deny him any Republican support, then it can't be bipartisan, even though the Democrats accepted 161 amendments from Republicans in the committee hearings on Obamacare. I'm a wonk. I'm a nerd. I remember that number. Incorporated the Heritage Foundation's individual mandate and worked incredibly hard to get Republican support. But in the end, even though he accepted a lot of Republican ideas and rejected progressive ideas like, not, God forbid, single payer, but even a public option, right out of the gate, to get Republican support, they denied it to him. So I agree with, I think it was Connie, this is what he faced from the get-go, and he tried for a long time to bring on some Republican support for his measures, and they denied it to him. So I do think that it started with them.
Connie, thanks for the call. Arlene in New Berlin. Hi, Arlene. Arlene, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, go right ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I enjoy your show immensely.
Thank you.
I am quite outraged at the way that both political parties are acting. They're acting like a bunch of school children, not like adults. And if the Republicans keep acting the way they are acting towards one another and towards the Democrats, I hope Hillary Clinton or the other gentleman win and that the Democrats get in, because these other people are just, I've never heard people talk about one another the way they are talking, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Arlene.
Mm-hmm.
Joan.
I've got to agree with Arlene as well. I think there's really kind of, it's not just at this point attacks on the Democrats, it's attacks on one another, and that the party really has to decide what it stands for. There are people who hope that there will be an establishment candidate who emerges, and there probably will, because, he will have the money. But the truth is, it's not clear what the Republican establishment stands for. And you have the emergence of a Donald Trump, and I think that's largely because the party has been cultivating a kind of nativist, reactionary, and in some cases, but some cases, racist base. Donald Trump's big claim on political attention came in 2011 and 2012 when he was the primary person peddling the idea that the president wasn't born here, and thus he wasn't a legitimate president. And, what did the Republicans do? Did they shut him down? No, they fought over his endorsement. And Mitt Romney, who I think is otherwise a moderate and probably a decent human being, went and kissed Trump's ring and proudly sought and took the endorsement of Donald Trump. It's not surprising to me that Donald Trump looks at what happens and says, hey, Mitt Romney's a loser and I can do this better because I'm the guy who's tapping into that anti-Obama, nativist, suspicious, sometimes racist base. They really brought their problems on themselves, as far as I can see.
Joan, what's the path to victory for the Republicans? What's the path for Democrats?
I think, speaking of the White House, which I know you are, I think the path to victory is kind of narrow. For the Republicans, because they've given up so many big states, and because their coalition is, you know, genuinely 89 to 91%. I want to get in the 89% of self-described Republicans in polls are white people, and in a country where the electorate is going to be something like 70% white, it gets lower every year, and so. They're having a hard time finding a path to the White House. I think their surest path is if Democrats really have a very bitter primary. It's been, you know, it's gotten nasty at times, but it's not truly bitter or disabling at this point. The losing candidate, whoever that may be, their supporters stay home. That sort of thing is more likely to elect a Republican than anything Republicans can do.
Thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Paul in Richland Center now. Hi, Paul.
Question in terms of where is Reince Priebus, who is supposed to be the Republican National Committee chair, in this fiasco they call a Republican primary? Now, let's not forget that it was Wisconsin that, of course, you know, made Reince Priebus what he is, because he was a great force in getting the infamous scourge of Governor Walker on us. And that's the only reason I ever thought he was appointed to be the chair of the RNC, because when Walker was the anointed golden child, then Priebus got the credit for that. But I don't see Priebus on any media, and I don't watch Fox News all that much, but I occasionally do just for the humor of it. But he isn't there either, and he's not quoted. Is he just holding out in a bunker somewhere waiting for this to all sort itself out? So that's just my question in terms of where is he in terms of doing anything to kind of make this a little bit more palatable to especially old-time Republicans who are extremely disgusted, like the 50, 60, and 70-year-old Republicans that are very disgusted with what's going on in their own party. So thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Joan.
I think that's a great question, and you're right. I haven't seen him very much lately. He came out, and he was very proud of himself a couple of years ago when he managed to change the primary schedule and also grab a hold of the debates. And work with the networks to set standards for, you know, who gets to appear in what debate. You know, up until the first debate, he was touting his role in doing that. But in fact, what's happened is I think that the polling, the way that they chose who got to appear on, you know, what stage, a lot of things that they did ultimately led, strengthened somebody like Donald Trump and, you know, let somebody who'd been a reality TV star, whose support was at least initially, I think, you know, a mile wide and an inch deep, simply on the basis of, partly on the basis of name recognition, you know, control the debates. Then, if you recall, Reince Priebus did, I believe he has a decent core, he did apparently privately chide Donald Trump about the way that he was talking about Mexican immigrants, calling them rapists and criminals. And his people, thinking they were very slick, leaked this phone call that he had with Donald Trump to say, hey, the chairman's not happy and he's said something. Donald Trump came back and said, that didn't happen, and Reince told me I was doing a great job. Then Trump began to threaten that he would run as a third-party candidate. Right. If the RNC was not nice to him. And so I think, I agree with Paul, he's really disappeared in the last month or so, except he might be on Fox because I don't watch it either. I think he really swung and missed in terms of trying to protect his party from a kind of freak show scenario that they had in 2012. And it's also really interesting, not to beat on poor Scott Walker, but the Republican Party was really, and the centrist, the establishment, they were really proud that, okay, 2012, they had Herman Cain, they had Michelle Bachmann, they had Newt Gingrich, they had some really kind of laughable, for various reasons, candidates. But in 2016, they were going to have this deep bench, and they were going to have a lot of governors, including Scott Walker, who were really going to have some centrist appeal, and that didn't happen. So I think even the establishment, as I said before, I don't think they understand what's going on with their party, and I don't think that they have a whole lot of control of it. And I think that that's true of Chairman Priebus as well.
Cheryl in Wausau, hi.
Hi. I feel like I agree with the speaker. I think we did bring President Obama in. He won. He deserves to go ahead and select a judge, and we should be following and supporting him in that. I also believe that they haven't said enough about what we need to do to get the legislatures, get some more Democrats in there when they're talking up there on stage. We're not just rallying behind a presidential candidate, we're also rallying behind everybody else who's going to be supporting that presidential candidate.
Yeah, you talked about the Republican organization. Are the Democrats, do they have a good ground game? Are the Democrats grooming younger talent? Are they organized, Joan?
I think that's a really good question, and I don't think that they're doing nearly enough. I think that we've seen the party really lose ground in at the state legislative level. Certainly people in Wisconsin know that better than the rest of the country. And that's where, that's who controls redistricting, and that's part of why we have this House that's really controlled by Republicans, even though Democrats got more votes in 2012. But the system has been rigged. But the system has been rigged, I think, because the Democrats have tended to focus every 4 years on the presidential race, which, of course, matters, but not do as much candidate development or voter education, voter development, in the off years or at the state level as they do at the presidential level. And I think, I know that there are some organizations trying to change that, but I think it's really a problem.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the Democratic debate on Thursday. We had a chance, Scotty and I, to go to that, and let's frame my question to you. Let's look at the age gap, significant age gap, in the vote for Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. This is an interesting comment from the mayor of Milwaukee, Mayor Tom Barrett, who is a Hillary Clinton supporter, but one of his children, Annie, his college-age daughter, is a Sanders supporter, kind of a divide in the family, and here's what he had to say about that at the Thursday night debate, and then we'll talk with Joan about this age gap. Here's Mayor Tom Barrett.
Well, I just talked to her last night in preparation for this, and it was a great, great conversation. Annie is very, very strong-willed, and she likes Bernie, and I obviously am supporting Hillary. And so we had a good conversation. In fact, this afternoon we texted back and forth on the issue. So I just love the fact that she's engaged in democracy, and I think that's what happened tonight. The winner tonight, I think, is democracy, because what you had is you had two serious candidates who care about the future of this nation. They have some disagreements, but you did not see the personal attacks that you see in the Republican debates. And you didn't see any attempt to try to divide this nation and pit people against each other. That, to me, is the fundamental difference. Again, you've got two candidates who understand that healthcare, jobs, education, incarceration, all those are real issues. But they were trying to deal with them, along with issues like foreign affairs, in I think, a very significant and serious way. So it wasn't a clown car. And I think that that's something that American people appreciate. It probably, the irony is, sometimes watching the clown car is more entertainment. I don't know that it moves the nation forward.
Mayor Tom Barrett in the spin room after Thursday's Democratic debate. What did you think of that debate, Joan?
Oh, I thought it was fascinating, and I agree with Mayor Barrett that, I'm a Democrat. I've endorsed Hillary Clinton, but I really respect Bernie Sanders, and I have, going back to practically college. I think we have two candidates who, again, it gets nasty occasionally, but it's not personal. It's not the way the other side is, and they're debating really interesting ideas for how to solve the problems that face our country. I am blessed, and I should also disclose this: we do not have a gap in my family. My daughter not only supports but is working for Hillary Clinton.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she worked for her in Iowa, and now she's in Nebraska. So we agree on this, but I really like the way Mayor Barrett put it, because I do worry that there's been a little bit too much disparagement by some Clinton supporters of the younger generation, and a little bit of lack of empathy, to be quite honest, about what they're feeling. You know, I really think you and I have talked about this before. I went to the University of Wisconsin, and I paid roughly somewhere. I think it went up each year a little bit, but somewhere between $350 and $400. It never went over $400 a semester. And when I, you know, every time I say that on your show, I get a tweet or an email.
I'm sure.
Or somebody just saying,
"What?
You're breaking my heart."
Right.
I'm not that old, you know.
No, you're not.
And so, you know, I think that some Clinton supporters, I'm not saying the secretary herself, but tend to underestimate the level of, you know, anger, and understandable anger that Sanders supporters, young Sanders supporters feel, that the country is not making the investment in them that it made in us, that's a way to put it. So, you know, I think that we need to keep the lines of communication open, and I think that they see and feel something that the Clinton campaign needs to do a better job reckoning with.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Larry in Stevens Point next. Hi, Larry.
Hi. First of all, it's the president's responsibility, duty, to make a nomination. But I think the Republicans that are calling on him to sit it out are cutting off their noses to spite their faces, because when Bernie and or Hillary are elected, they'll have the opportunity, if it's delayed, and it's going to be a more liberal candidate, and they ought to take advantage of the opportunity when Barack's going to appoint a reasonable candidate. I think they're just stupid.
Well, they may win. They're thinking they're going to win, right, Larry?
There's no way they're going to win.
Why do you say that?
Because they're cutting their legs off by yelling at each other and through these ridiculous debates that they've been having.
Joan.
I think that's really an interesting point, Larry. I mean, I think that I'm almost surprised at McConnell, because he did say he was really determined to show that Republicans could govern. And I, as a progressive, I'm going to say this aloud. Every once in a while, I worry about President Obama. I think he does concede too much. And I can imagine a scenario where he and McConnell sat down and he agreed to nominate someone more moderate than perhaps he would want in exchange for a hearing and hopefully confirmation. And the fact that McConnell came out of the gate saying he would not allow that is, I think it's politically stupid. I think it has I really do think it has the power to energize the Democratic base, which I think is going to be an interesting challenge for either Clinton or Sanders in November. I think that especially the African-American vote, which is the backbone of the party, black women are comparable to white evangelical men in their loyalty to Democrats versus those men and Republicans. They are often neglected, and I think people have legitimate questions as to whether Hillary Clinton can do enough to see the kind of turnout that President Obama saw, whether she's tapped into the right networks, et cetera, et cetera. Bernie Sanders, I think, would have even bigger problems, but let's leave that aside for the moment. I think that if they continue to defy and disrespect this president and keep him, basically cut his term to 3 years instead of four, like the white presidents get, I think they could really do a lot to turn out the Democratic base. I think Larry is right that they're cutting off their nose to spite their face, and they may well be looking at a President Clinton who's going to appoint someone more liberal, and perhaps a loss of the Senate, too, which means she could do whatever she wanted, virtually, within limits, not that she wants to do anything crazy.
Let's talk about the African-American loyalty to Hillary Clinton. What's the basis of it? How strong is it, Joan?
I'm not going to speak for the African-American community, but my experience and my reporting tells me, you know, the black vote is very pragmatic. It's a smart vote. It's not a symbolic vote. So, you know, you remember 2008, Kathleen, then Senator Clinton had a lot of black support, had much more support than young Senator Obama, because a lot of black voters did not think he could win and were not going to waste their vote on a protest vote or a symbolic vote, because their constituencies really suffer when, you know, I'm just going to say it, when Republicans get in office and cut programs and attack voting rights, et cetera. It's a pragmatic, policy-based vote. It's not symbolism, and it's not about color. The black candidate was not getting the black vote. When he won Iowa, everything changed. When he ran an unbelievable campaign, things began to change. And when he began reaching out in very smart ways to the black community, things changed, and she lost a lot of, not all of her support, but a lot of it. This time around, she's got it. Is it as passionate as it became, but became for the president? Probably not. But, you know, she's hoping she can make it that way. She's gone to Flint. She's made the water crisis, the criminal water crisis in Flint, Michigan, a campaign issue nationally. She's raising money for Flint folks on Twitter. She's doing a lot of what she has to do. And Senator Sanders, quite honestly, is not doing enough of what he has to do. And part of his problem is that he does, you know, speak very critically, and it's his right, but very critically of the president, and in a way that some African Americans feel is disrespectful and doesn't take into account the obstacles President Obama has faced. So, you know, I don't think she's there yet, and I would never presume to speak for the black community, but from my reporting, she's getting there, and Senator Sanders is making inroads with younger African Americans, which is great and which really matters, but isn't as far along as she is, and you can see that in the numbers.
Mm-hmm. One more call for you. I know you have to leave early, and we'll just keep taking phone calls the remainder of the hour.
Thank you.
Brian in Madison, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on two things. Number one, and I believe Joan has touched on it, I just don't remember a time in my lifetime that the position of the president has been so disrespected. And I don't care whether you're Republican or Democratic. I just feel that the president has been just terribly disrespected in his term. And secondly, because it's gotten so bad, do we feel that it's time to try to set term limits for Congress and for Senate? And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right. Thank you. Thanks, Brian. Joan, just briefly.
I'm sorry, Kathleen. Brian's very last comment.
Term limits. Term limits, yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I that hasn't worked so well in some states. I think that's kind of a drastic solution. I would just rather see a lot more people turn out and a greater emphasis on voter education and voter cultivation and voter turnout.
All right. Thank you. Happy election time. Happy President's
you.
Day.
Happy President's Day. I hope we talk again soon.
I'm sure we will. Thanks, Joan. Joan Walsh, our guest for Most of All Things Political. Don't go away. We are going to take more of your phone calls. She had to catch a train to Washington, I believe, so she had to leave us about 10 minutes early. Joan Walsh, who's been with us many times before, she is now the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation magazine, and she has declared her support for Hillary Clinton. We're going to welcome more phone calls. We have a couple clips to play from our time in the spin room at Thursday night's debate, Democratic debate at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And I'm sure the question of the hour is still, should the president name a replacement? Is it his constitutional duty to do so for Justice Antonin Scalia? And should the Republicans obstruct that vote because it makes sense for them politically, or would it work against them? Should it be up to the next president? We're welcoming your phone calls on that issue as we round out this hour here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scotty and I were in the spin room. We never got a chance to meet the Democratic candidates because they were across the street, but in addition to having a chance to talk to, interview many of the people in the spin room, we wanted to get some of this tape and bring it back to you. So we'll play just a little bit, and then we'll go back to phone calls for the remainder of this hour. This particular interview is with you. Maybe you've seen him on television before. He's a young African-American member of the state legislature who has decided that he used to be for Hillary Clinton, and he has switched to support for Bernie Sanders, who's attempting to round up African American support, which will be important to him in South Carolina and in the states that will follow. So here he is talking about his change of support and what the civil rights icon John Lewis had to say about Hillary Clinton and expressing Congressional Black Caucus support for her. This is State Representative Bambert from South Carolina in the Spin Room on Thursday night.
And I wanted to be very clear that Senator Sanders, along with myself and everybody else, has nothing but respect for everything that, you know, Mr. Lewis has done for African Americans, for civil rights. But whether or not he personally saw Bernie or spoke with Bernie, it is of little significance in a sense that it does not minimize what Bernie Sanders did. So you have to understand that during the 1960s, what Bernie did, for instance, leading efforts to desegregate housing at the University of Chicago, those were not popular in and of itself, but it also was not popular for a white person to do. So Bernie Sanders did do these things. He did make these efforts. And if you look at what he's talked about over the course of his career, racial justice, social justice, economic justice, these are things that Bernie has been passionate about. He made it clear tonight. He's made it clear from day one. So with all due respect, I mean, Mr. Lewis is entitled to think as he wishes, but I don't believe that it minimizes at all what Senator Sanders does or what he stands for.
The Representative Justin Bamberg from South Carolina about switching his support from Hillary Clinton to Bernie Sanders, this at the Democratic debate on Thursday night. All right, let's quickly go to some more phone calls and just hear what your thoughts are on the Supreme Court and on the race. We go to Jim in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen. It's Jim. And I'm commenting. I think I disagree with your guest on the Democratic Party's chances. Because the strength of the Republican Party candidates is the width of its field. Unless they nominate Trump or Cruz, I think the Democrats are going to have problems because we have a narrow field, a 74-year-old socialist, and Hillary Clinton, while she's competent, her unfavorables are almost as bad as Trump's, and she has as much baggage as an ocean liner. So as a self-described progressive and a Democrat, I have concerns about my party in the fall. And I'll take your comments
And the Republicans, Jim, who do you think would stand the best chance of winning?
Kasich would destroy the Democratic field.
Hmm. What about
Ralph here?
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. I'm just listening to you. I'm not giving my opinions on this. I'm all ears. Sarah in Lake Zurich. Hi, Sarah.
Hello, Kathleen. Nice to talk to you. I was just thinking about when you asked how could the Republicans, what's their path to the election?
Yeah.
I remembered how their path once before was to go to the Supreme Court. And that made me wonder, what can the Supreme Court do when there's eight people on it? And I kind of thought that they could uphold a law, like they can keep hearing cases and they can uphold laws that they can't overturn them. And do you have any idea if that's true?
I think it's just pretty much status quo, that it stays the decision of the lower court until there can be, it would be a tie, so it would revert to the opinion of the court that brought it to the Supreme Court.
Okay, that's kind of what I was thinking. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, so what do you think should happen here? Should the president nominate? Should the Senate confirm up and down?
Well, yes. I mean, it's just, wow, I'm just like flabbergasted, like your guest said, that it's even a question. Of course he should. We voted him in. He's got a job to do.
Thanks.
Should the senators just stop making votes in the Senate because they're a lame duck senator? I don't think so.
Thanks, Sarah, for your call. Jean in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I called. There's plenty of us women up there over our 60s. I'm 61. That truly do support Bernie Sanders. I've been following his career 20-plus years, and he has been a fighter for all of us. And I know women in their 70s and 80s who are Bernie supporters, too. So they can't really lock us older women out because we have a voice, too, and we've watched Bernie, and we like what we see, although we will support Hillary. But Bernie's our man for now.
All right. Thanks, Jean.
Yep,
thanks
bye.
Very much for the call. Randy in Key Wascom, hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, Obama has can nominate somebody, but that doesn't mean that the Republicans should just go and fall down and accept whatever extremist he nominates. When you talk about nastiness against judicial nominees, a term coined because of the Democrats comes to mind, getting borked. You had somebody who was extremely qualified who the Democrats ravaged. And that's where things really got nasty since then. So to go and blame the nastiness on the Republicans, give me a break. And as far as being the nastiness starts at the top. Obama has been divisive since day one. For the first 2 years, he basically told the Republicans to shove it up their butt.
All right, Randy, thanks for your very strong opinions. We'd like to hear all of them. And thanks, everybody, for your calls. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this show. Thanks to Kendra Smith, our wonderful new intern, for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. It's been quite a weekend, hasn't it? Quite a weekend. So we have news coming up, and then please stay with us for the next hour of our show. On this President's Day, it's nice to look at a phenomenally great president in our past, and of course it's Abraham Lincoln, and a different take on why he thought fighting the Civil War was worth the possible loss of life.